Support for WPR comes from Fitchburg Family Pharmacy, offering the full line of orthomolecular vitamins and supplements, with home and work delivery available. Information about services is at whatagreatpharmacy.com or on Facebook.
Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about pet care on the show today and beginning by talking about dogs a bit. And we'll start by talking about books for animal lovers. And Patricia McConnell should know because she knows a whole lot about animals and she knows a whole lot about books. Certified Applied Animal Behaviorist, international speaker, author of several guides on training and behavior problems, some real dandies there. And she probably won't talk much about her own, but she should. But as the holidays draw near, it's a perfect time to think about books. What are you trying to teach your dog? Let us know how we can help you find a gift for an animal lover in your life. The number 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Patricia McConnell, great to see you again. Thanks for coming by.
Oh, it's my pleasure, always.
You have a list of great books to give to animal lovers this season. And, well, let's just start. Tell us about the books you chose. You've got some dandies from
the sound of it. Well, I have an hour's worth of books to talk about, Larry. So if you were thinking of calling it, no, I'm just teasing. But there's so much out there. So I promise not to talk too fast, but I'm so excited. There's so many great holiday gift books or books everybody needs to gift themselves, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think we should all give ourselves a holiday gift. One of them, actually, we talked about last time I was in the studio. It's called Dog Smart by Jennifer Holland. It's about canine cognition.
Great book.
Isn't it great? Larry loved it. I loved it. She's one of those great science writers who goes everywhere, immerses herself in the ocean, and, you know, she just does it all, right? She's fearless.
Mm-hmm.
It's a wonderful book if you're interested in canine cognition. There's another book that came out this year that is one of my absolute favorites. It's called Manage It, A Hack for Improving Your Dog's Performance. And it is, I love this book. And here's a quick example of why. You know how the advice when you get a puppy is like you should crate train it and you should teach the puppy to be happy in a crate at night, right? So it won't pee somewhere. And she's like, no, put it in the bed with you. And dog lovers everywhere are like, we love you. We love you. She's like, your puppy's going to be, you know, it's been sleeping with warm bodies, right? Put it beside the warm body. She talks about how to avoid accidents. But the whole book is full of what professional dog trainers do all the time, which is manage a behavior problem, often rather than try to, quote, train out of it. Another one by a dear friend and colleague, Zazie Todd, it's called Bark, The Science of Helping Your Anxious, Fearful, or Reactive Dog. Zazie is she's just one of the best. She's so good. She's so thoughtful. She knows the science, but she makes it so relatable and easy to read about. Again, it's called Bark, The Science of Helping Your Anxious, Fearful, or Reactive Dog. Another one, Canine Enrichment for the Real World by Ali Bender. It's another great book about keeping our dogs happy and content. You know, we've taken away a lot of stimulation out of their life. You know, we just have. Yeah. It's just the way it is. They live in houses. We control everything. We take them on leash walks, you know. So this is a wonderful book to have a healthier, happier, and a dog with fewer behavioral problems. Again, that's Canine Enrichment for the Real World. There's one more dog-related, and then I'm going to go to animals.
Okay.
I have a few more. There's one more dog-related book that is just gorgeous. It's basically a photo book with some short essays. It's called Abandoned. Abandoned by Catherine Carver. She spent years taking photographs of dogs who just came into the shelter. And then a year later, she takes a photograph of them. And the differences are
monumental,
stunning. And the photo, so there's a little essay about each dog. But she's a professional photographer, and it is stunning. It's a beautiful, beautiful book. So if people are interested, like, well, what else? That's not enough, Tricia. What else is out there? Go to dogwise.com. Dogwise.com. It's one of my partners, so I'm, you know, I'm invested a little bit.
Sure.
But they are basically the Amazons, except they're wonderful, lovely people of the dog world. So those are all dog-related, but let me open it up to two books that I absolutely love that are about animals and animal behavior. The most important one that came out, I think it was this year, and it might have been last year. It's called An Immense World by Ed Yong. He is a science writer. He is one of the best. This is a book about how our reality is just a tiny, tiny slice of reality, that our perceptual boundaries create a world where we only hear, see, smell some things, and then we learn about all the other ways animals, the reality that other animals live in. And it's fascinating. It was a New York Times bestseller. It's a big read, you know, but it's, oh, it's a wonderful book. And then my friend and colleague, Franz de Waal, one of the country's greatest animal behavior researchers, wrote, one of his last book was, Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? His first book, decades ago, was Chimpanzee Politics. He's
Remember
just
that?
A wise, wonderful man. It's just a tragedy that we lost him in March. So two fiction books, though, for animal lovers. And this is, oh, I'm so excited about this. I haven't read it yet. I have it. I'm so excited. It's called Familiaris by David Wroblewsky. David Wroblewsky wrote a famous book called The Story of Edgar Sawtell about a man and his dog. Do you remember that, Larry?
Oh, yes, very much. Had him on the show.
Yes, I love that you did. Well, you need to have him again, although this book is going crazy. I think it's another tome. He does not write short books. It's like 400-something pages. But I actually fangirled him. I was giving a seminar here in Madison. I had read his book and just thought he was one of the best authors I'd read. He came in and said, I have a dog question for you. And I literally was like fanning my face, like fangirl. I was like, it's David Wroblewsky. So new book, Familiaris. Do not want to miss that one. And then this is an oldie but a goodie, or a set of oldies. Who can forget James Herriot? You know, a lot of people haven't read him, right? A lot of people, the TV series is out.
Yeah.
The books are absolutely.
I loved all of them.
And he, you know, I went back and read some of them before I started on my novel, and he is a great, he was a great writer.
Yeah.
They are really, really well written, and they're charming and lovely and wonderful. So I have one more. Do I have time?
Have one
I been,
more.
I feel greedy. So one more. And this is actually something that relates to Giving Tuesday. There's a book called Love Has No Age Limit, a booklet that Karen London and I wrote together, designed for people who are bringing home a non-puppy, an adolescent, an older dog, a mature dog. Because there were no, when we wrote this, there were no books out there about what do you do when you're bringing home an 8-month-old dog or a 4-year-old dog. These dogs have histories behind them. And they're not little blank tabula roses, right? They're not little 8-, 9-week, 12-week-old puppies. So all kinds of new challenges come up. We have kept costs down so far in that people can buy it in bulk and donate it to their favorite shelter or rescue. And on this Giving Tuesday, December 3rd, there's another sale on it. So you can buy, hopefully people will jump on, go to my website, buy a bunch of these copies, whatever you can afford. They're on sale. And they're pretty close to basically what they cost to make, if not less. I probably shouldn't even look at the numbers. But that's the hope. I just was last week at Dane County Humane Society and donated a bunch of them and some of my other books. So that's the hope. People will jump online on my website, Giving Tuesday, December 3rd, and buy a whole bunch of copies of Love Has No Age Limit and donate it to your shelter of rescue of choice.
Oh, that's wonderful. And we have that we have your list. I
don't think you do, but I can get it to you because I just wrote it this morning.
Well, you do that.
I can fix that. I can do that.
Okay.
We can take care of that.
Patricia McConnell, our guest today. It's so much fun talking with her. We've gone through a nice list of books. We can talk about gifts for animals as well. And you can join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. What if you want to give your dog a gift for the holidays? What makes a good gift for Lila, who I like a lot?
Lila.
Or Fido, or whoever.
What a sweet name. Well, you know, one of the tricks is to know the dog, so sometimes it's a little hard. You know, I'll buy my favorite chicken-based treats for my friend's dog and then discover they're allergic to chicken. So the trick of a good gift for a friend of yours or family member who has a beloved dog is to find out more. And you can be I've gotten really pretty sneaky about it. So I'll just start a conversation about, you know, I bought a new something for Maggie and Skippy and none of them paid it, you know, neither of them paid any attention to them. You know, Would Lila like that or something? Just ease your way into the conversation. Because some dogs like that kind of chew toy and not that kind of chew toy. You know, some dogs like chicken-based treats and other dogs can't have them. So I think there's a gazillion things to buy out there. What's the pet food industry now? How many billions of dollars is it? I don't remember. It's a lot. But find out as much as you can about the dog because they're individuals just like we are. And, you know, you've probably gotten presents that you don't like, you know?
Yeah,
I got a chew toy last year that I haven't touched all year.
Michael and Kakana will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Michael.
Hi. I really appreciate the subject, and I love when Trish is on. Always an enjoyable show. My wife and I have experience bringing home puppies, older dogs, and two of the middle ones were rescues, and each one is a personality. It is so much fun. You have to adapt because you have to listen to them, even though they can't talk, by their body language and who they are and what they like. We had one who was a four-year-old, and she was the toughest. It took her almost a month to she knew she was in her new home, and she was loved. We lost her young to cancer, and that still devastates me. Two years later, she died of cancer just when she was becoming a pet. We had to be so gentle, so careful, so soft with her and listen to what she liked, what she didn't like. And we brought home our latest puppy, and he just came in the house and said, "Hey, I got a place of my own. I don't share with my siblings anymore.
I'm good."
Yeah, it's fun. So thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling.
I'm sorry about your dog. How sweet of you to be so patient. You know, some dogs are so frightened and so traumatized. It can take them so long to just relax. And it sounds like you were so patient. So, thank you.
I'm thinking back to Lila, who, when she came home to her new home, it was it seemed kind of surprising because she didn't bark at all and didn't bark for a month and a half before she let out her first little bark.
That's actually a big problem. I used to see clients who's like, we took the one who wasn't barking at the shelter. The one wasn't barking at the shelter because it was sort of stunned and in shock and scared. And, you know, it can take a certain amount of getting your paws on the ground. You know, I talk about the famous threes, 3 days, 3 weeks, 3 months.
So, there you go. Mary Ann in Oregon has a comment for us. Let's go there. Hi, Mary Ann.
Good morning. Thank you for your wonderful program.
Thank you.
I just wanted to add to the list of marvelous books you're suggesting, and this one is an older one from 2002, written by a lady by the name of Kristen von Kreisler. Have you heard of it?
Well, what's the title? What's the title?
Beauty, sorry. Beauty in the Beast.
Ooh. I don't know that.
Oh, my goodness. It's from 2002, and it's multi-species, actual, true, verified accounts of marvelous things different animals have done for each other and for other species. A potbelly pig who saved his human's life, for instance.
Oh, that sounds...
Or a horse that protected a baby rabbit. I mean, these are true accounts of the dimension of emotion demonstrated by different species of animals, and it's just heartwarming.
Sounds Beauty like the perfect Beast. Holiday book, Beauty and the Beast. We all need to be uplifted, right?
Yeah.
Especially around the holidays, I think. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I wrote it down. I'm going to check it out. Thanks, Marianne.
Marianne, appreciate it very much. You can join in, too. Number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell for WPR News. We've been taking a look at some books for you for the holidays that involve your dog or other animal with our guest, Patricia McConnell, certified applied animal behaviorist. And we're talking about other issues as well when it comes to dealing with your pet. Laura in Fond du Lac, as a matter of fact, emailed us. You can email to talk@WPR.org, or I should mention, you should also phone us at 800-642-1234. But for the email, Laura, her dog Molly began marking in their bed after losing her companion dog a couple of years ago. In fact, some of her other behaviors have become more like a male alpha dog. She marks several times during a walk, while she used to just urinate once. She also recently began going after the kitchen garbage. They now have to lock both their bedroom door and their kitchen cabinet before leaving the house. Since she usually only does these things when they're not at home, it's hard to know how to teach her not to do them. So wonders if you have any suggestions for that.
Well, yeah, I do. I have some thoughts. So Molly had another dog with her in the house, and these things happen when you're gone. So Molly is alone in the house for the first time, right? A lot of dogs have a lot of trouble with that, you know, and it's not crazy. I mean, they have no power, and they know it. They can't open the door, right? They can't, well, some of them can't get to the food. It sounds like Molly's figuring that out. But it's really common to see all kinds of behavioral problems that seem sort of here or, you know, hither, thither. Is that a word? Hither, thither? I don't know. Well, it sounded good.
Sounds good.
It does. Fun to say. But you know what I mean. You know, you just get this range of problems. So that I would actually treat it. I would hypothesize, you know, does she have separation anxiety? And that's treatable. I have a booklet on it. You can go to my website. There are other really good booklets on it, treating separation anxiety. That could help a lot. And it's not easy to do. It just takes a certain amount of patience and time, but it's usually very, very successful. So I would, you know, manage the garbage and just make it impossible for her to get at and pursue that whole question of, is this separation and anxiety related?
Yeah, it makes sense for sure. Jeremy in Mineral Point has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Jeremy.
Hey, how y'all doing? Love the show. I just wanted to express that, you know, I'm an animal lover. I have a dog and have had a dog for a long time. It means a lot to me. And I'm struggling lately with, like, animal lover identity. And I feel like sometimes when we hear animal lover, we think about people who extend this overwhelming love, care, respect, dignity, and so forth for animals. But sometimes the perception is that these things aren't elevated to the humanity piece, right, and connected back to all living things and living ecosystems. And so I feel a sort of pressure, a sort of shame, if you would, to kind of conceal to what extent I am super huge animal lover, particularly dogs and cats. And the other thing I wanted to mention is that, like, on TikTok, if y'all haven't had a chance to, like, really get into it, there's a lot of wonderful things there. And there's TikToks about dogs and cat lovers, particularly in the Black community, and to what extent, like, folks are caring and loving on these animals and, like, doing it in such a dignified, loving, caring way. Like, it's a beautiful thing to witness, and I empathize and connect with that because I am that person with my dog. So any thoughts on, like, animal lover, stigma, identity, and how to respond to this era that we're stepping in?
Yeah.
Can we have the rest of the hour? Because yeah. I love this question so much. Thank you so much for asking this question. So here's I don't have time to say all the thoughts swirling around in my head, except again, thank you for getting people thinking about this. I think for me, the best way I know to look at it is I actually learned at the university when I spent so much time studying primates and humans as primates and humans as animals. We are animals, right?
Yep.
So I think it's really important that people who self-describe as an animal lover, in the kindest, most humane ways possible, we need to keep reminding them that humans are animals too, and that we deserve love and respect and dignity. And, you know, we are a very complicated species, as we all know, and we all know that there's a downside to human behavior in many, many, many ways. And I think any way we can find to remind people, and, you know, I'm thinking of the books like of Franz de Waal, you know, and The Immense World, you know, who talk about sort of humans and our place as an animal in the rest of the animal world. You know, the more we can do that, I think the better the world will be. I will tell you, there is a segment of the positive dog trainer population that is, it's extreme in my view, in that if you don't use 100% positive reinforcement, they can get very negative, right? Ironically, and me and many of my colleagues, you know, talk about if you're invested in positive reinforcement, like I am, and I've spent my career, right?
Yeah.
Talking about its importance and how to use it and how to do it, then we need to do it for everybody. You know what this reminds me of? Karen London's fabulous book. Karen London is a friend and colleague. It's full disclosure. But she wrote a great book titled Treat Everyone Like a Dog. And it's basically how to use the principles of positive reinforcement and other facets of the science of influencing the behavior of animals in a kind, compassionate way and to use them on people, whether it's your son or your spouse or most importantly, perhaps yourself, right? So that's, I just think it's so important for if you are, I love this question, if you are an animal lover, the person who irritates you at the, you know, at the mall, you know, or on the road, who's behind you and, you know, tailgating you, that's an animal too. And if you are an animal lover, then just keep in mind that person is an animal too. And don't even think about talking about or thinking about or doing something towards them that you would not do to a puppy that you found on the street.
Yeah. And what's the title of Karen's book?
Treat Everyone Like a Dog. Brilliant title, right? That should be on everybody's list too. It's dog, all dog lovers will love it. I have to tell you, I read it once a year or twice a year because it just reminds me, oh yeah, I could be doing that to help me change that bad habit I have. Not that I have any bad habits, Larry.
I was thinking back as you were talking to when we were hosting the national show, Calling All Pets, and someone calling and on this very topic, and she had some, I don't know, not the best of issues always with her husband. And so she had read about this very topic. And about 2 weeks into her experiment with her husband, he said, "You're running the same thing."
"Are you training me?"
"The same thing you're doing with the dog."
Well, and you know, here's the irony. A lot of people will often say, like, "Well, isn't that manipulative?" Well, when you use punishment, that's manipulative. Yeah. We're all trying to influence the behavior of those around us. That's our job, part of our jobs in life. And you can either do it in a kind, humane, effective way, or you can do the opposite. Jeremy, thank you for that question. You made my day.
Thanks, Jeremy. Dawn in Oshkosh will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Dawn.
Hi. Good morning, you two. I just wanted to, good segue, Larry. I just wanted to mention that I miss you two on Calling All Pets because you were a big part of my Saturday morning every weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I have a mastiff named Bruce, Dr. Bruce Banner, because he's named after the Hulk. And he's a broken mastiff. Aww. Love him to bits. He's an English mastiff, but he's a broken mastiff because they're supposed to guard hearth and home, but he's afraid of things like tipped over garbage cans, vacuums, brooms, barks at the rake. Anyways, I made a mistake with him when he was a puppy, and I would get on the floor and play with him and, you know, play bow to him, and he'd play bow back, and he'd bark at me. Well, now I can no longer get on the floor in my house or at my cabin without him bowing and barking at me and going crazy.
Because you trained him to do that.
I did. My own mistake. You need to train me. So how can you train me to untrain him to do that?
Oh, we all do that. Every one of us has done. You know, the best dog trainer in the entire world has done that. I absolutely guarantee you. So, and so this is a good one. So think about, this is very solvable. So think about, what do you want him to do? So maybe you could teach him that when you lie down, so like a new trick, right? So when you lie down, he lies down. So I would, and it's very, you can do this in 2 weeks. So first of all, yeah, if you don't have a lie down, teach a lie down, right? You know, get a dog training book. I have a few out there. But just get a real positive reinforcement dog training book. I like to use food as a lure to get a dog to lie down. So get a dog to lie down on cue. You can use a visual cue. That's often very helpful. So just do that like 3 or 4 times a day. You're not lying down. You're not getting down, right? You're just teaching a good lie down. Or you're just sort of pumping it up. So, you know, he's really mastered it. And then after you feel like he's really mastered it, then I want you to dip your shoulders down just, you know, maybe a foot, and then stand erect again. As you dip your shoulders down, I want you to say, lie down. Good boy. Lots of reinforcement, right? Maybe some treats. Great idea. Maybe some play. So what you're going to do is you're going to gradually turn the cue lie down from your voice to your body. So you dip your body, right? And you're going to ask him to lie down. And then you dip it farther, and you ask him to lie down. And then you dip it farther, you ask him to lie down. And eventually, at some point, you're just going to crouch halfway down. You're going to look at him and wait. I'm waiting. And he's eventually going to go like, oh, I'm supposed to lie down. So you're going to just switch the cue. That's all. And if you can do it once, you can do it another way. And then what you might also want to be doing is adding more appropriate play. maybe teaching him find it outside, where you just throw some big treats around and teach him find it. It's really easy. It gets really busy. Great nose work. Really good for their brain and their bodies. So teach him another way to play that doesn't involve mauling you.
Dawn, there you go. I love that. That's a great piece of advice. Dawn, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Well, Kathy emailed us. A family member she visits often has 4 large dogs, 2 Great Danes, 1 old lab, and a 3-year-old Golden. When you come to the home, all dogs come to greet you. However, the Golden runs in a circle and then starts playing with, this is Kathy emailing us, the Golden runs in a circle and then starts playing with Kathy's dogs, and she cannot get through and is afraid she will get knocked down. So what do you do about the Golden, which it's her friend.
It's not her dog, right?
Not her dog.
That's always trickier, you know?
Yeah.
Training your friend to train their dogs is a little trickier. I mean, the first thing to do is just not hesitate to say, you know, Marcia, you do me a big favor? I'm just feeling nervous that I'm going to get knocked over, and that would not be good for me. And we would just hate the whole ambulance thing, and it would ruin our day. Would you mind putting the dogs in another room, or even just the Golden or something? You know, I've got my dogs trained when somebody comes to the door, even though they're really quite polite. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Skip is like, hello, hello. Maggie barks some. And I don't know if the person at the door is a dog lover, if I don't know who it is. So I just say, hey, go in the study, guys. And they run in the study because I trained them to do that on cue. I gave them lots of treats, and they'll just run in the study, shut the door. So life is simple. So it's pretty easy to teach a different behavior. What doesn't work is punishing the behavior you don't like. What does work and is antithetical to the way humans tend to think, what does work is figuring out what do I want the golden to do, and then creating a way where it makes it easy for him or her to do it, and then reinforcing that, and then challenging it a little bit more and more. So I would take your friend to lunch and go through all that and see what you can do. I will tell you, I have to use a cane now, and I tell all my friends, oh, get one. Oh, get a cane. It's great. Because people are so nice to you, you know. And so if you show up the door with a cane, your friend is going to be like, oh, dear. I apologize to people. I don't hope I haven't offended anybody who really needs one. I do, too. But I've learned to appreciate the good parts of it.
Mark in Nina. We'll go to you now. Hi, Mark.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
I have a little Chihuahua mix, and he was a rescue dog, and I know he had some abuse in his past from what I see physically. I mean, he had frostbite marks on his ears, things like that. He wasn't treated. The ears have grown back. It's pretty cool. But anyway, my question is, when he's under a blanket, like in our bed or something, or he's under a blanket wrapped on the couch, a lot of times when you disturb him from under the blanket, he starts growling and becomes very aggressive and will try to bite. And I don't know if that has to do with something that happened in his former life, you know, like somebody put him under a blanket and beat him or something. I don't know, but I don't know how to kind of get a hold of that.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a tricky one, and it might be related to his past, but frankly, I doubt it, just based on all those years of experience and knowing how many people who have little tiny dogs, Chihuahuas are high on the list, who are like, don't bother me now, you know? I mean, they're so tiny, and they so need to protect themselves, right? You know, they're mm-hmm. so vulnerable. So, I mean, the easy answer, and I know the answer of a lot of behaviorists is and trainers is going to be like, you know, he lost his bed privileges. I am all in on dog sleeping on the bed. If you can still sleep well, there's some research that suggests people don't sleep as well. I don't sleep with my dogs in the bed just because I don't sleep as well. But dogs need... Basically, they need, you know, the bed privileges are a big deal, right?
Mm-hmm.
So one thing to think about is to create a little bed that's on the floor, you know, make it warm because it's Chihuahua, right? I mean, there's those so thin skin. So get a really cozy, you could even get a little, we used to have a little heated cat house that lived in the garage because we had a cat who had to be outside at that time. And so it's just you plugged it in, it was heated, and it was really cozy. So you might be able to teach your Chihuahua to sleep comfortably beside you, same room, right, down mm-hmm. on the floor, so there isn't that problem. That might be the easiest solution. It's going to be hard. Is there a quick piece of advice I can give you? No, there's not. I want there to be a quick piece of advice where I can say, do this, Mark, and everything will be fine. It's just going to be more complicated than that. I can't give you the quick answer is don't let him sleep on the bed. Mm-hmm. But hopefully here's a way to make that would work for you. To try and, you could possibly use counter conditioning to teach him that every time he's touched, something good happens, you know? So he's in bed, you touch him and you give him a treat, you touch him and you give him a treat. Problem is, I've had so many clients whose dogs were asleep when you touch them, and then they just sort of wake up growling, and that could be related to some kind of traumatic past. That's sort of harder to turn around. So yeah. I guess I'm going with my first idea, back to that heated, cozy bed. And if not, you could sleep in that. Your Chihuahua could sleep
sounds
in the
cozy.
Big bed.
Sounds nice.
And you'll all be safe and fine.
Mark, thank you for calling. Mary in Neillsville, Your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hi. About 2 years ago, I adopted a rescue dog from a puppy mill. She's part Pomeranian and part Chihuahua. And it took a long time for her to bond. And when she bonded to me, she is bonded to me. She follows me from room to room. When I sit down, she must sit in my lap. But my biggest problem right now is she's suddenly gotten a little bit braver. And we had deer hunters, friends that stay with us. And this weekend, they were in the house staying overnight, and she stood on the end of my bed and barked continuously the entire night.
Oh, that was restful.
Oh, boy.
Oh, dear. Is she normally afraid of strangers?
Yes.
Oh,
normally, she used to run and hide, but now the last few months, she's gotten braver. She'll come running in the room and leap on my lap, and she'll bark at him the whole time that she's running. And then once she's on my lap, she's fine.
Because she's safe, right? She's up high. She's safe. She's got her big homey pack backup person there, right? So, this is fixable. Well,
maybe,
probably. I mean, the good news is I know what to tell you to do anyway, and I think you might help. It's very common for fearful dogs with traumatic histories to be sort of shut down at first, and it's the story that you're telling is so common. As they relax and get more comfortable, they are able to act on their fears, right? So I want you to start counter conditioning her to visitors. I have a booklet called Cautious Canine. There are other things out there. You can go to dogwise.com. They're written by other people, some really good things out there. You're basically trying to change her emotional response to visitors. So you set it up. You figure out what treat you can give her that's good for her. It's not going to hurt her little tiny pieces because she's a palm chihuahua cross. But what's going to happen is visitors will come in the house and throw treats on the ground far away from them so she doesn't have to come close. And they don't get anywhere near her, basically, but they throw treats, and then they go away. And then they come back, and they do it again. I used to have counter conditioning parties for clients, so we'd get a line of, like, 10 people to come in, and each one would throw treats and then leave. So you gradually work your – I can't go through all the steps on the radio, but you gradually work your way up so that she becomes more and more comfortable with strange people, unfamiliar people coming into the house. And no longer is being driven by that fear of strangers. So good luck. It's very possible to turn this around. And good for you for rescuing this poor little thing.
Yes. Mary, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Patricia McConnell is certified applied animal behaviorist, international speaker, author of at least 10 guides on training and behavior problems. Probably her most famous book is The Other End of the Leash, which is published in, 13 languages?
Yes, I always forget. It's 13 or 14. Yeah, it's done well.
It's done well, and there's a reason for it. It's a wonderful book. Our guest today, and again, you can join in. I hope you will. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Coming up at noon today, it's all about cats with Dr. Angie Ruppel, who's founded a mobile clinic that's helping our rural cats in particular. And we'll be talking about the importance of cat neutering and spaying. So that coming up at noon right now. Patricia McConnell with us. Yeah, that'd be good.
Sounds like a great show. Yay for her for having a mobile clinic, going to rural areas.
Yeah,
that's
absolutely
fabulous.
John emailed us with a question. Facebook video reels now have a number of examples of wild animals going to humans for help to rescue another animal in distress. What's the probability that these examples are occurring because the animals have been previously exposed to humans as rescued wildlife? So the rescued animal turns around and goes to a human for help.
That's a really interesting question. Here's my guess, and that's all it is. Guess is that that's not that common. You know, some of the examples I've seen, it's like, you know, what was the possibility that that dolphin actually escaped from SeaWorld or something, you know? So I'm always cautious because of AI now. I mean, I've seen so many things lately that have been like, yeah, that didn't happen. So I'm pretty cautious. However, that does not mean there aren't very credible examples of that happening, you know, either one dog or individual or, you know, any kind of wildlife trying to enlist a human's help in getting a net off of a, you know, whale or, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So my guess is it's more about most of the animals I've seen do it. And now I wish I could go back and, like, you know, watch 100, 100 reels. But very often the animals involved are social animals. So if you look at the ethology of social animals, you know, there's a genetic predisposition to look to other individual creatures, right, animals, for some kind of help. And so that's my best guess is, you know, does it happen with solitary animals? I mean, would a panda, for example, do that? You know, they're pretty solitary animals. I don't know. That's my best guess, is that it has something to do with the social nature of the animals who do that. And it's like, well, you're not a wolf, you know, or you're not a moose or whatever. But, well, moose is not a great example, but y'all get the idea here. And that, you know, you're not my species, but you're something, right? Or perhaps they have observed humans doing things that made it clear that we have all kinds of powers that other animals don't. That's a research. I love that. So many good questions.
Yeah.
I love this. I have a terrible answer to this question, but I love this question. We're all going to have to think about this for a while.
I like your thesis, your theory on social animals being the ones that are more likely to do that.
You're kind to call it a thesis. It's a wild ass guess, but it's the best one I can come up with right now. Great question, though. Thank you, John.
Jerry in Sun Prairie has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Jerry.
Good morning. I have a 14-month-old cockapoo, and we play with him, and we've got these squeakers on that. And we throw him, and he'll go get him, and that, and we'll be playing back and forth and that. And my girlfriend will do the same thing, you know, we'll take turns and that. He'll bring him over. But then all of a sudden, he'll just drop it, and then he'll start pulling at my girlfriend's pant legs and pulling on it, trying to bite her shoe or something like that.
Whoa.
And, yeah, and no reason. I mean, because we're playing with them, you know, and stuff like that. And that. And then the second one is, he has a tendency that if, let's say, he gets a hold of a sock or something like that, or a shoe, or something he's not supposed to, something of ours, like, you know, like a towel and that. And all of a sudden, he'll, you know, he won't give it back.
Sure.
He'll sit there and growl. He just growls it.
Yeah.
He gets possessive, right?
Yeah.
My sock. Well, let's talk about your poor girlfriend first. Because here's my guess, is that what it sounds like is that your cockapoo is getting hyper-aroused. Arousal is a big issue and often a very problematic issue with our dogs. Again, you know, they don't have a lot to do, right, compared to a wild canid that you know, is their evolutionary background. And so some of these games where they're fetching toys, for example, with squeakers, they can get really aroused. And then somehow that arousal just, there's just like, I don't know, it's like a bunch of teenagers at a rave or something. It's just too much excess energy, right? And it just sort of spills around and gets into big trouble. So what I would think about is I would try only playing this way a short period of time. And then I would have a cutoff signal that animals use to each other all the time, which basically is just like, that's enough. That's enough. Not playing anymore. So I would say, that's enough. And then I would get up and walk, just sort of change the scenario, you know, just get up, walk somewhere else, go outside, maybe play a little game outside, like find it again. That's my favorite trick right mm-hmm. now. This is so useful for so many dogs. And see, my hope is that that will solve that problem, because I think your cockapoo is just getting over aroused and your girlfriend is an easier target than you are. So that's that part. And then the possession, very common problem with some dogs. So you, what you need to do is you need to teach your dog, I call it leave it. I say leave it. And you can do it starting with something that's not that special for him, right? You know, maybe he's just sniffing the ground or something, and you have a great treat in the hand behind your back, and you say, leave it, and he just looks at you like, what? And you say, good, and you give him the treat. And it's like, oh, because what happened is he looked away from what he was looking at. So you start with just looking at things, and then you gradually, over a period of weeks and months, work your way up to there's an object in his mouth, you know, and eventually mm-hmm. something he really, really loves. And here's the hard part. When you get to the point where he has a sock in his mouth and you've progressed so far that you say, leave it, and he drops it, you say, okay, and let him take the sock back, because that's what he really wants. That's the best way to use positive reinforcement, is figure out what an animal wants, and often it's the problem behavior. So Skip, when I first got him, he was 3.5. He's a big, strong dog. He would practically knock me over going out the door to go to the barn, because he loves it more than anything, and he hits 25 miles an hour in 10 strides, right? Not that I'd ever exaggerate, but pretty close, right? So I taught him to wait at the door by using running to the barn as a reinforcement. I'd say, wait, and he'd just pause and look at me like, what? And then I'd say, go to the barn. And then I gradually just made him wait, asked him to wait longer and longer. So that's the way you're going to work with the possessive part, okay? But basically start with treats, start easy, create a win, because I don't want somebody to get bitten here, because, you know, that would be bad. We don't want that to happen.
No, we don't. Jerry, thank you so much for calling. Annie in Rhinelander says her husband really wants to get a dog. She's never been a dog owner. Really nervous about getting a dog and is worried she won't like the experience of being a dog owner. Any words of encouragement?
Yes, yes and no. I mean, I would never want to talk somebody into getting a dog, you know? I would, what I would encourage you to do is to spend some more time around other people's dogs. You know, if you're nervous about getting a dog, I mean, I guess my question, and we don't have time. Again, I need an hour, Larry. I'm sorry. You keep doing this to me. But what I want to know is, what scares you? You know, is it the dogs themselves? Or is it that you won't be a good enough owner, you know, human, handler? You know, figure out what scares you and start working at it that way. You know, it might be that you don't want all the responsibility, and it is a lot. There's no way around it. We all see people who have dogs who shouldn't, frankly. Mm-hmm. So think about what it is that scares you, and then follow along that line, you know. And I would go out of your way to spend time with other people's dogs. You might think about fostering a dog, but I caution you about, like, bringing in, like, a rescue dog who might have a difficult past.
Yeah.
What you might want to do is, say you have a friend who has just the sweetest golden retriever in the world, right? Or the sweetest little poodle. Ask him if they could stay in your, you know, can you come over and spend the night with your dog? See what it's like to have, they're responsible for the dog, you're not. And you'll get a sense of what it's like to have a dog in your home. So those are some thoughts for you to pursue.
I think those are some really good thoughts.
I hope so.
And here we are, out of time, Patricia. This has been such a quick hour. I want to thank you so much.
Oh, it's always fun, Larry.
And we hopefully you'll consent to doing it again.
Oh, just twist my arm. It'll be so hard. Happy holidays, everybody.
Patricia McConnell, certified applied animal behaviorist, international speaker, author of many books and guides on training and behavior. Always great to have her with us. And she will come back and we will do this all over again. Coming up, as I said, we're going to talk about spaying and neutering your cats, among other things, with our next guest. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining in today on WPR News. Today we're talking about cats and the importance of getting them spayed and neutered with our guest, Dr. Angie Ruppel. Dr. Angie's been practicing since 2003. She founded Purple Cat Mobile Veterinary Clinic. Clinic provides low-cost spays, neuters, and vaccines in Northwest Wisconsin. Also has physical locations in Baldwin and in Eau Claire. So as we talk with Dr. Angie, I hope you'll join in. Tell us how your cat's doing. What are your questions about neutering or spaying your cat? Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Dr. Angie, welcome to the show. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We are going to talk about neutering and spaying cats today. Just why is it important that cats be neutered and spayed?
Well, I guess the biggest reason is that I do it is because we see so many unwanted litters of kittens. When I was first in Cumberland at the Northern Lakes Veterinary Clinic, I would go out to the farms and there would just be so many cats and kittens running around, and they were often sick with conjunctivitis and other respiratory infections, and it broke my heart. And I really, by spaying and neutering, we can prevent those unwanted litters and really make cats healthier in the long run.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And you're the founder of Purple Cat Mobile Veterinary Clinic. What's that? Tell us a little of the history of that mobile clinic. What gave you the idea to get it started and going?
Yeah. So I worked in Cumberland at a private practice for about 14 years, and I had a couple of clients that, in particular, that often would ask us to make spay and neuter more affordable for the cats in our area. And it was really hard and difficult as a private practice to do that because we had our regular clients to fit in. And but it was always on the kind of on my mind. And then there was a horrible tornado in Chapek, and I think that was 2017. And one of those clients was rescuing cats that were living in a colony in Chapek, and they no longer had a home because of the tornado. And so I talked to her, and she talked to me, and it was decided that I would help spay and neuter those cats during my lunch hours. And I had a great boss, Dr. Eric Stone, and he was fine with me doing that. And so I worked with Wendy, and we spayed and neutered a bunch of cats from Chitek over my lunch hours, and then she was able to get them adopted. And I found that really fulfilling. It surprised me how much I enjoyed that and how it fulfilled what I thought of my career. And so after that, I decided that I wanted to do more. And so that's really where Purple Cat Mobile Veterinary Clinic got started. I reached out to some of the shelters and humane societies in northern Wisconsin. And it took a little bit of time. I had a day off, day or two off. And so I would spend my days off traveling to shelters in Ashland and Superior, Lady Smith, Mondovi for a little bit, and I would spay and neuter cats at the shelters, and then they would bring in the public cats to also get spayed and neutered.
Well, it's an amazing story, Dr. Angie. What is your mobile surgery unit look like?
So when I first started, this wasn't something I was really wanting to take out big loans to do, and I'm a do-it-yourselfer, my husband a do-it-yourselfer, and so, and I really, my goal was to do farm cats, and so I really didn't care too much about what it looked like, so I actually used an old trailer that was used as an ice shack, and I just gutted it as if it was a room in an old house, so I just gutted it, and I put a window in it. I'd need my windows, and I put surfaces that could easily be cleaned. And I, my husband helped me wire it, and it got a heater in it and some nice stainless steel counters. And so that's what I used for the first couple of years. And I truly was a mobile clinic at that time. I went to farms in that, and it was really great. It got me started. But then what happened is, after COVID happened, my services were just, I was so busy. I was doing it out of my driveway in that trailer, and so many people were coming that needed surgery. They were driving over 2 hours from Minnesota, northern Wisconsin. And so that's when I used the trailer a lot, but when I got so busy during COVID is when I got my permanent locations. And that way I could see a few more cats every day, having the permanent locations in Eau Claire and Baldwin.
Marvelous story. Mary in Independence will give you a chance. Hi, Mary.
Good morning. I just have to give a shout out to Dr. Angie. She and her crew were wonderful in helping me with an overabundant cat population on my farm. And I had a variety of cats, some a little bit tame, some very, very, very feral. They didn't turn any of them away. They were just, I can't say enough about it. So affordable for me. Changed our farm cat life. Thank you, Dr. Angie. Thank you so much.
Oh, Mary, that warms my heart. Thank you for calling.
Oh, yeah, Mary, thank you so much for calling in with that. And those kinds of calls or those kinds of notes you might get from people are just in person have to mean a lot, Dr.
Absolutely.
Angie.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We
have other callers online with questions and comments, and let's take a call. Let's go to Julie in Winona, Minnesota next. Hi, Julie.
Hi. My 16-year-old male cat has just recently been diagnosed with kidney disease, and all our veterinarian did was put in a prescription diet and say that we should make sure that he drinks lots of water and watches his urine production.
Julie, you're really breaking up. I'm sorry. Julie's cat was diagnosed with kidney disease, and the prescription was to put it on kidney disease diet, basically. And Julia's wondering, is there any other way to manage something like that?
So kidney disease is horrible. It's common. Up to 25% of senior cats develop kidney disease when they are older. I'm sorry. I've seen it a lot, and it's always sad. The change in diet is the first thing we do. It slows the progression. So kidney disease, you can never stop the progression. You can't reverse it. You can only slow the progression. And so the low proteins and the other ingredients in the kidney diet will help slow the progression of kidney disease. Once the kidney disease is advanced enough, you'll find that he gets dehydrated easily because the kidneys can't concentrate the urine as before. And so at that point, we will start to sometimes add supplemental fluids in the way of subcutaneous injections. And some veterinary clinics will do that, have you come in for that once or twice a week. Other veterinary clinics are willing to teach you to do that at home on your own. Hmm. But the fluids and the diet are the two main things. But there are some other supplements out there that can be helpful. It kind of depends on the current research and what the current research recommends.
Yeah. Julia, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. How do you make these surgeries affordable, Dr. Angie?
Yeah.
I mean, you're kind of, in a way, you're taking money out of your own pocket and giving it to somebody else, sort of, in a way, or letting them keep it.
Yeah. So it's all about efficiency. I started out, when I first started doing this, I scheduled myself for 20 cats a day. And that was a full day of surgeries. And I never played a musical instrument. And so I didn't really understand muscle memory. And now I definitely understand muscle memory. It was probably 3 years into it that I realized how fast I was getting. My hands just automatically do the surgeries. And so so that's how I do them so fast myself. But then I have terrific staff. I have two certified veterinary technicians that work with me. I have two veterinary assistants that work with me. They are all great, all efficient. They're super hard workers. They're easy to work with. And so it's a combination of just my skills and muscle memory along with great staff.
And these would you call them MASH clinics? You set
yeah.
up? Yeah. What is the MASH clinic? what is a MASH clinic?
So that's a hybrid. It's where I would take all of my supplies to a location and set up in a big room. And so that's what I started doing up when I was transitioning from using the trailer to my permanent locations. I would take everything with me and set up in a room at the Ashland Humane Society, for example, and then I would unload and take it back home with me every day.
Wow. I got to believe that this had an impact on rural cat populations during this time.
You know, you'd think it would. I've every 6 months to a year, we always see the numbers that we've done. And so we're currently at over 40,000 cats in 6 years. And I don't know how that's possible, but it is. And
wow.
I keep thinking that eventually we're going to run out of cats, and then maybe I can open my services to do dogs. I get questions all the time, when are you going to do dogs? And my answer is, well, when we stop having so many cats to do. And I have found that I'm just as busy. I think that we're hitting new populations. I don't think that it's not us not making an impact. I think that we are expanding our services to people that haven't heard about us yet. We have trappers and folks that work in rescue and TNR, trap, neuter, release, who will work on colonies of cats and bring them to me. And they do a really nice job with follow-up at these colonies to make sure that they stay under control and that any new cats in the population are spayed and neutered. So as far as the population as a whole in Wisconsin, as a whole, we must be making an impact. But there's so many cats out there. You just have one farm that might have 100 cats on it.
But I really
try to focus on... So when I do think, wow, how are we still seeing all these cats? I try to focus on the individual colonies and farms that no longer have the problem, just like Mary, the first caller, where, you know, we fixed it. And so now they can keep, now they have a healthy colony of cats that whose population is kept under control.
And the permanent locations you have two, and one in Baldwin, one in Eau Claire. So you must be going through a lot of surgeries, and I assume you're offering other kinds of service through those permanent locations.
Because we are really focused on efficiency, if we're not efficient, we can't do the numbers that we are doing. And so we really focus on cats spaying and neutering. And then we do have, we started this year, we have distemper and rabies for cats. Walk-in clinics. So we do that once or twice a week.
Yeah.
But those are really the only services we do.
Dave and Toma has a question about relating to feral cats, I believe. Dave, hello.
Yeah, hi. You know, you had a guest on from the DNR a few weeks ago about the bird population, and I want to know what you're doing with these feral cats after you fix them.
Well, they typically go back to their farm, and they're no longer reproducing, and so you will find that the population gets more stable. It goes down in time as just because of age, they are no longer there. Sometimes diseases still can reduce those numbers.
And Steve in Fitchburg has a question for you as well. Steve, hello.
Hello, thanks. So I live in a 60s subdivision of a city south of Madison, and there's a neighbor who I have not met who has structures outside of their house that I understand has she houses this house houses shelters feral cats. If I'm going to invest in feeding birds because I like birds, I see conflict, and I'd like to know more about it. It's a segue from Dave's question.
And I'm not go ahead, Dr. Angie.
So the question is, how do the cats impact the bird population?
Yeah, that might be the question, or the question is, how do you approach if the person has those cats that are, if they're feral, are they neutered or not?
Yeah. So, you know, as far as, I don't know what the city statute state as far as housing cats and feeding cats. You know, I deal with the people and trying to get their populations of cats spayed and neutered. I think that as far as the birds in your area, if they are well fed, they're not going to be going after the birds as much as you'd think. And so I don't know that those necessarily are always intertwined.
Our guest today, Dr. Angie Rupo, a veterinarian and founder of the Purple Cat Mobile Veterinary Clinic. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to WPR News. Zeroing in today a bit on spaying and neutering cats with our guest, Dr. Angie Rupo, a veterinarian founder of the Purple Cat Mobile Veterinary Clinic. Great to have her with us, and I hope you join in. Maybe we got an email. You can email us to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And, I just wanted to mention, we're getting into the holiday season. I wanted to let you know that Santa Claus will be stopping by this studio this year. We'll have him on the show on Christmas Eve, and he'll be ready to take calls from our young listeners to talk with them about their Christmas wishes. So that's on Christmas Eve. In the meantime, we have Vivian in Green Bay with a comment. Let's go there. Hi, Vivian.
Hello. I have a friend of several decades, rural. She has cats, and then recently one of her three cats got out, and she was concerned that it would come back pregnant. So I said, well, why hasn't she stayed? And finances are part of the problem, but not all of it, because I've offered to do this. And I've helped her out in the past in other ways. So, you know, I could help with that. I've got five animals of my own. But she says that the surgery is too hard on these cats. She doesn't want to do it. Five kittens last time had to go to the shelter. I bring that up. What are the other benefits of doing the spaying besides keeping them in and not adding to the population?
What?
So,
go ahead, Dr. Angie.
So I'm wondering if she maybe had a bad situation happen, and that makes her a little bit nervous to spay and neuter a cat now. There's always risks. Surgery is not without risks, but those risks are very low, especially if you are doing the surgery on a cat that's still, you know, usually I say less than 7 years old. After seven, they're considered more of a senior cat. So benefits, of course, they won't have litters of cats. You are removing the ovaries and the uterus, and so they don't get ovarian cancer. They don't get infections in their uterus. They don't roam as much. They stick around. Those are the biggest. The biggest things, mammary cancer, breast cancer, we don't see that very often in the spayed female cats.
All good points, Vivian. I hope you're able to use them on your neighbor and friend. Dorothy in Williams Bay, your turn. Hi, Dorothy.
Hi. Hi, Larry. So first I wanted to just make a comment that how hard it is that some people think that it's okay to just drop off a cat that they don't want at a farm or in a forest preserve. And I'm not quite sure how to get that across to people to understand that that's not okay. You need to be responsible for your pets. Okay, so here's my situation. I have 9 feral cats that are all neutered, and I'm feeding them. And I don't see very much of them going after birds. I don't feed the birds in the summer because the cats can hide in the bushes and stuff. But in the winter, I feed them, and the cats don't have a very good chance of getting them because everything's covered with snow. Anyway, so there's my 9 cats. And with the doctor there, I know you're going out and you're fixing cats at farms and stuff. But then my problem is, how do I give these animals flea and tick medicine and tapeworms especially, because I can't take my feral cats into the vet and get a prescription for something that really works, like Bravecto really works, but they require that the vet give it to me. So does she have a recommendation for how I can get this medicine to protect my cats from fleas and ticks and worms?
Dr. Angie?
So veterinarians need to have a relationship with the clients before they can prescribe medication. And so typically we call it a veterinary-client-patient relationship, which means your veterinarian knows you and they know your animals. And otherwise their license can be called into question if they are prescribing medication without knowing their clients. So that's pretty standard that would be a requirement. I totally get it. This is something that comes up all the time as far as how to get flea and tick medication for these cats. Some veterinarians, if you have a good relationship with your veterinarian, some of them may give you prescriptions based on the fact that they know you and they've maybe met 1 or 2 of your cats. They do not necessarily have to meet all of the cats. So that's where I would start, is seeing if they were willing to give you a prescription after doing an exam on one of the cats. And even if they're feral, you can take the cat into the vet clinic in a live trap, and then they can do some sort of a visual exam just to put it in the records that they did do an exam.
Dorothy, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Julie in Sparta, your turn. Hi, Julie.
Hello. Thank you for being there. So, you guys, I have a 3-year-old male neutered cat that we found was living in one of our sheds. I've gotten him fixed. The last month, he's been dropping weight. I took him to the vet. We had a blood test. It came back fine. She said there was a little bit of a calcium level, you know, that would be, you know, that I should look at. The other part is he's home and we're going on 2 weeks now and he's still not gaining weight or eating. I mean, he's drinking a little bit. He tastes a little bit. He's eliminating. But so today I started injecting no salt chicken broth in him. And then a little bit of the gravy from some of the cat food, because I'm just concerned that he's going to waste away. And maybe it's some mental thing of him being in there with the cats, that he's being bullied. I don't know what's going on, but I got him checked. So my main question is, what would be the best supplemental thing to give him to help him survive, if possible?
Good supplement.
Yeah, so he's 3 years old, and he has been neutered. Do you know what test they did when you took him to your veterinarian?
I don't. I'm sorry, I don't. They said I could pay for more and have further tests done, you know, in regards to the kidneys. But we've got two dogs, probably one cat on purpose here, and now we have 9 cats and 5 dogs after 18 years. So, you know,
wow.
It's fine. We love them, and we've probably found at least 30 animals homes just in the 18 years. But you know, you end up with some of them regardless.
Yeah. So, you know, there's definitely going to be a reason that he's losing weight. It's not going to be that he's upset about a housemate. At least it's sounding like he has significant weight loss. And so I like that you're syringe feeding him some low-salt chicken broth and gravies. That's a great thing to do. Does he vomit after you do that?
I have not found vomit yet.
Good.
No. I want to know, how many times do you think I should keep injecting him? Because up till now, you know, I wasn't. But I'm like, that there's no way that he needs help.
So I don't know how much to feed him because I haven't seen him in person. I haven't seen his blood test. I don't know what the underlying cause is. I think to really know what to do, he needs more tests and probably more blood tests. And sometimes x-rays and imaging is needed. And I know that's costly. I get it. I mean, that's a huge reason that I'm still doing what I'm doing is because there isn't affordable options for spaying and neutering. And I also know how much it costs to go in and get those blood tests. So my heart goes out to you if this is a cost issue. There's not a whole lot that I can recommend for that reason, but keep doing the syringe feeding. As far as calories, you can, I guess it depends on how much he's eating on his own. I really can't comment too much more on that because I haven't fed him.
Yeah. We have Beth in the Madison area with a question as well. Beth, hello.
Hi, this is Beth.
Yeah, what's on your mind?
Hello, hear me? This is Beth.
I think we're having a problem there with Beth, so we're going to move on and turn to another question, and this has to do with the actual process of doing the spaying or the neutering. Is it difficult to, I mean, cats can be nervous. My cat, I have 2 cats, and they're both nervous when they go to the vet anyway, but cats and their owners both get a little nervous before a surgery. How do you help your cat relax before a visit to you or another veterinarian?
That's a really good question. One thing to do starting out when they're kittens is to get them used to the kennel. A lot of cats will just run and hide as soon as that kennel comes out. And so as kittens, if you can make the kennel part of the furniture so that they are used to that, you can put a bed in there, you can feed them in the kennel. You want them to like that kennel. And so that's number one. Now, if you haven't started that as a kitten, you can start that anytime. You don't want the first day you introduce the kennel to be the day they're going to the veterinarian, because then you'll never get them to go to the veterinarian. So start with the kennel. And so if you haven't done that as a kitten, you can start when they're adult. As soon as you make that appointment, just start getting that kennel out there and see if you can get them to eat inside of it. And then the day of surgery or the night before, you can put the food in there. They go in there and eat, and then you can close the door on them. And then there is medication. Gabapentin is one that is commonly used. It's an anti-anxiety calming medicine, and that can be given to cats the night before and again the morning of. And that's a nice calming medication that will make the visit much more enjoyable for them.
First, you have to get the cat to eat it.
Yeah, we'll give it to our clients that we have already met. So again, that's client veterinary patient relationship. So if we have a client that we've been working with and we know their animals the way we send it home is with a little canned cat food sample. And then it's a capsule that they can open, mix it in with the canned food, and the cats eat it really well.
What happens during the surgery itself? And, you know, how quick is this operation, this spaying or neutering?
So it will depend on the veterinarian and their skills and their experience. When I was first doing surgeries, just out of vet school, my spay, and I'm kind of embarrassed to say, was about 20 minutes long. And but that's probably close to typical for a lot of veterinarians. Now, same exact surgery, but my incisions are smaller, and so that makes it go quicker, and my hands are faster. Now the surgeries are somewhere between 5 and 7 minutes. And then as far as a neuter goes, those probably are, I'd say 3 or 4 minutes in length. Probably a lot less. It just kind of depends on the prep.
Yeah, and then what kind of stitches, you know, do you put in the cats?
The boy cats don't get any stitches. Their skin just kind of sticks to itself and okay. Easy that way. The girls, they have a suture on the body wall and then one just below the skin, and then there's a little glue on top of the skin.
Okay, so, and then recovery afterwards, is there, you know, I'm wondering what kind of post-surgery care do any of the cats require?
Usually not very much. Clients always ask about putting an e-collar on their cat or a surgical bodysuit, and it's pretty uncommon for the cats to be licking after surgery, and so we don't worry about licking, but it can happen. It's just not very common. We don't want them to run around. We don't want them climbing the curtains and jumping off because that can disturb the sutures, cause more pain mostly, but potentially bleeding. So we do want them to be quiet for about a week. Having said that, you know, with all the cats I've done that live on farms and go back out the very next day and live their regular life, it's pretty rare to have a complication from too much activity afterwards. They limit themselves.
Beth in the Madison area has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Beth.
Hi. Yes, I appreciate you taking my call. My question is actually for my daughter's cat, and I just heard from her today, actually, that she and her husband are very disappointed. They feel as though they're going to have to rehome the cat that they've had for 4 years. It is their second cat. They have a first cat, and they brought a second cat in as a companion. The cats get along great, but their second cat, Mo, has apparently been peeing around the house and has done this continually for about 4 years. They've taken the cat to the vet. This cat is neutered, as is their first cat, and the vet says it's behavioral, not anything health-wise, and I'm wondering if you have any recommendations of anti-anxiety medicine or any behavioral suggestions so that might help them to not have to rehome this cat.
So the cat doesn't use the litter box?
No. He pees in the basement and on the floors, and when they're home or when they're gone, he doesn't seem to want to use a litter box. And it's been in through two different apartments and the home they now live in. It has been since the beginning. They got him from a shelter, and they're not sure if he did that in his previous home. They really don't know.
Yeah, that's frustrating. A lot of owners have had cats that urinate inappropriately. I'm glad they took him to the veterinarian. The veterinarian always wants to make sure that it's not a bladder infection, that it's not bladder stones. Both of those can cause pain. When there's pain, the cat's going to want to urinate outside the litter box because they're trying to tell you that something's wrong. Sometimes stress can cause it as well, but that's, again, something that the veterinarian probably would have picked up on. A lot of times with stress, the cats will have inflammation in the bladder, and that will cause blood in the urine. And so the veterinarian should have picked up on that. So if they've ruled out all the Medicare, the the medical reasons, then we do look at behavioral. And there's a lot with behavioral, and this is probably something that their veterinarian already talked to them about. There's handouts that we often give folks. But it starts with making sure there's enough litter boxes. If they have two cats, they need at least three litter boxes. Sometimes we have you try different litters. You can do the non-clumping litter. Sometimes the cats just like the good old-fashioned litter. So you want to make sure that it's not a problem with the litter. Is it scented litter? Sometimes you have to give them a buffet of litters just to see if there's one in particular that they like. So that's one way, one place to take this conversation. There's Feel Away is a common product. It has pheromones, just a good smelling pheromones that cats get from their mother when they're nursing. And so that can be very calming for cats and help them not help them if there is a stress causing this. And then finally, there is medication, and this is often a place that clients don't want to go, but there are medications that can be helpful in these situations.
Yeah. Would calming medications, or what kind of medications?
Yeah, they're more like antidepressant-type medications.
Oh.
Yeah. And so actually some of them are human drugs that we can give to cats.
Beth, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Angie Ropel, our guest today, veterinarian, founder of the Purple Cat Mobile Veterinary Clinic. She does lots and lots and lots of spaying and neutering of cats. It's great to have her with us, and you can join into it. 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Our guest today, Dr. Angie Ropel, it's great to have her with us as we talk spaying and neutering with your cats. And here's a question. You may have addressed this a little earlier, but how does your cat need to be, how old does your cat need to be to be spayed or neutered? And then on the other end, how, you know, when is it too old?
Yeah, I did not cover that yet, so I'm glad you asked. So for the typical pet cat, we want them to have had all their kitten shots, and we want their immune system to be pretty mature. And so we do recommend 6 months of age for the pet cat. It will just make the surgery have just be the least chance of complications. I work with a lot of shelters and humane societies, and for those folks, their goal is to get these kittens spayed and neutered and then adopted out. And so for those folks, we will do it as young as 8 to 10 weeks of age, as long as they have had at least 2 vaccinations.
And on the other...
And then as far as if it's too old, we... In general, we want to do it at our clinic. We want them to be less than 7 years of age. Once they're 7 years, they're considered seniors, and you can have a higher risk of complications. However, that doesn't mean they shouldn't be spayed and neutered. We still absolutely want them spayed and neutered. If you found a cat and it's 10 years old and it's not, and he's not neutered, we still want you to have him neutered or spayed. If it's a female, but then we would want you to take them to your full-service veterinary clinic where they do the pre-surgical blood work. They have more in-depth monitors to make it a safer surgery.
Yeah. And what if you think your cat's pregnant? Can she still be spayed?
Yes, she can. It kind of depends on you and your own what you want to do. Some clients do not want to spay a pregnant cat. They want them to have the kittens. Other clients will have them spayed. For us at Purple Cat, if they come to us pregnant, we will spay them. We don't check for pregnancy prior. It does make the surgery a little bit, have a slightly higher risk of complications. So we go through that briefly with the owners so that they understand those risks. But yes, we will definitely still spay them if they are pregnant.
And I've heard some people say that obesity can be a problem after a spay or neuter. How accurate is that, and how do we prevent it if it is?
Definitely cats, and really dogs too, their hormones change after you remove the ovaries, and so they are prone to obesity and gaining weight. The hormones change so that they not only do their metabolism slow, but they actually feel more hungry. So it's an awful cycle. And so the only thing we can say is just feed them less. You can't free feed them. You have to meal feed them and watch their intake and watch their weight. And if they are gaining weight, you just have to reduce their food.
And if you've got, you deal with this all the time, you have a lot of outdoor cats at your farm, how do you round them up so a vet can come and fix them?
Yeah, so that can be tricky. Most of our, we've got the farm clients that have friendly cats, and so for them, they will borrow kennels often from their county humane society or shelter. And so the friendly cats, they'll just, maybe at feeding time, maybe the cats are used to being fed once or twice a day. At feeding time, the friendly cats, they'll just grab and put them in carriers. If they're feral cats, then they will hopefully be able to borrow live traps from an area shelter or humane society, or sometimes there's other folks in the area that have live traps, and then they will live trap them a few days before the clinics.
Wow. And how often do cats need general checkups?
When they're kittens, they should go to the veterinary clinic, usually monthly. They're going to be weighed, make sure they're growing appropriately. The veterinarian does a lot of educating as far as maintenance with deworming and flea and tick preventative. Vaccines are the probably the most important part of these kitten exams. We want, just like human babies need their vaccines and boosters, so do cats and dogs. And so those initial kitten visits are for health checks and then those vaccines. Usually we end the vaccine series once they are 16 weeks, some sources say 20 weeks. At Purple Cat, we recommend 20 weeks to stop the vaccine series. And then we do another booster at a year. And then, and this is specific for the vaccines. So we do a booster at a year and then every 3 years on the distemper. So after those kitten vaccines and they're done with that series, then we still want to see the cats usually every year just to check their weight, check their health status, look at their teeth, make sure that there aren't problems that the owners are missing. And then once they hit 7 or 8 years of age and they're in that senior age range, then we recommend seeing them sometimes twice a year because they are aging faster and disease can creep up on them.
Yeah, that makes sense. And again, the vaccinations, which ones do they absolutely need?
So the core vaccines are the ones that we recommend for every single cat, no matter if they're only an indoor cat or if they go outside. And so those core vaccines are the rabies vaccine and the distemper. And we call it distemper, but it's your typical 3-in-1. It's the Khaleesi virus, the herpes virus, and the panleukopenia. Those are the core vaccines. And then depending on the cat's lifestyle, if they are in contact with other cats, then we usually want them vaccinated for feline leukemia.
Okay. And here's a question from how do you prevent your cat from getting fleas?
Fall is when we see fleas. Fall is a horrible time. So the only way to prevent it is by putting those topicals on the cats and doing it on a regular basis. So even indoor cats can get fleas. It's so frustrating, but those eggs can come in on your feet. So let's say you have rabbits that are running around outside. Eggs can fall off. You can bring them in on your shoes. And so even indoor cats that have never been outside should be on a flea preventative. I've personally seen those indoor-only cats get fleas. And there's many, many products. They are I believe they're all prescription products, and so you'll have to go to your regular full-service veterinarian to get those.
Yeah. And can you still bring your cat into the vet if they have fleas?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, that's just part of life. Cats have fleas, and so they will often recommend treatment of those fleas, and then they will treat the clinic will get treated so that they don't survive and then go on to other patients that come in later.
Sandy emailed us, could you discuss cats and blood pressure? She's currently dealing with this with a very scared rescue kitty. She knows when they take her into the back of the clinic to check her blood sugar, it probably makes her very stressed. And best practices for getting a cat's blood pressure.
So, yeah, I mean, absolutely, cats do get stressed. And generally, we'll take three readings and take the average of the three readings, going in there more often for the blood pressure so that they're more used to it can be helpful. If you give calming medication, that might cause inaccuracy in the reading. And so blood pressure is definitely tricky. I would say know the veterinarian and the technicians. There's probably staff that are better at calming the cats and taking the blood pressures versus somebody that's new and fumbling and not sure what they're doing. So yeah. I would talk to the particular staff at your clinic and see what they can do that's particular to your cat to make it a better experience.
You know, when I go to see the doctor, they take my blood pressure right away, and it's always a little high, and then they have to take it a second time, and then they say, oh, your blood pressure is actually normal.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Do you have any here's one more email. Any recommendations? Let me give you this. Is there any reason the spay-neuter surgery couldn't be done by a licensed vet tech? Would that enable more access to clients seeking the service?
So I think that in some states they are trying to pass that certified veterinary technicians can do the neuter surgery. But definitely I don't think it's possible for them to do the spay surgery anywhere. A lot of the roadblocks have to do with the anesthesia, and only a veterinarian holding a DEA license can have the anesthesia. And so that's probably is going to be the big thing that prevents it. Even with neuters, I've found that it's such a quick surgery. I don't know that it would make it any better, even if the certified technicians could do that one.
Well, this has been a great conversation, Dr. Angie. I want to thank you for the work you do. You're providing a valuable service in northern Wisconsin, and it's much appreciated, I know, by the clients you have. And appreciate having you with us, and I hope we can talk again down the road. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Dr. Angie Ropel, veterinarian and founder of the Purple Cat Mobile Veterinary Clinic, and she has a couple she does MASH clinics, and she also has permanent locations in Baldwin and Eau Claire. Great to have her with us. And great to have you listening in today. Our show is always a team effort. Our producers, Clara Kniper, Joel Patnod, technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. Tomorrow on the show, are you wondering what happens to the stuff you throw out? We talk with about landfill microbiology, and you'll hear from the author of the book as well, titled A Natural History of Empty Lots. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mealer.